Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, great to be with you too.
And on the political left, Shireen Gorbani.
Hello, and hi, listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
We're all in studio. Got a lot of things we're hoping to talk about, and I have no particular order today, everyone. So just bear with me as we kind of go through this.
This is the Scrum edition.
Roadwork.
Yeah.
Shireen, Salt Lake City is like torn to bits with so much construction going on. John, I don't know how it is in Utah County and coming here, but what do you make of it?
Oh, okay. So a couple of things. I'm really excited about some of the infrastructure investments that are being made
in Salt Lake City. I'm really excited about the traffic jams.
I really am. Like, let me tell you. So I'm a big fan of the bike lane that has been built along 900 South, really stretching across, connecting east and west. I rode it last night over to TF Brewery to meet a friend for a beer. And I just have to say, it's like such a beautiful trail. And now, like, considering that that's going to connect all the way over to the Whale is really exciting. But it has been a huge burden on businesses that are in along these roads. And we're seeing more and more of this happening. I know Sugar House is going to be, I think, 21st South, like kind of close to where the Barnes & Noble is, is my understanding, is going to be closed. And I would just ask people, if you're in the neighborhood, even if it's inconvenient, if you're not in the neighborhood, park in a neighborhood and walk over and support these businesses. Just a visit to these shops, to these restaurants, really means a lot to help them through a time that's really difficult to be there.
John, we talk about public policy, the role of government in a market economy. Why would I start out with talking about road construction? But it's a
I don't know. That is a riddle.
It's a primary function of government to provide this infrastructure.
Is it because you're on the Transportation Commission?
Because I spend so much time in Salt Lake City.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm also an avid runner. I run through City Creek multiple times a week. They're resurfacing that road, which has been absolutely potholed and terrible. So it's really great to see all of the improvements and investments that are coming along on our trails and on our roads and bike lanes in particular.
Yeah. Well, we have a certain window of time because we have winter and you can't really do much then. And so you got to just quickly get it done in the summer.
Yeah, you do. John, this is a state that always invests in infrastructure. And it started in a big way when you served in the legislature. I mean, not started, but it was a
big jump. I think it went all the way back to when Brigham Young came on down in and started laying out Salt Lake City.
Yeah. So one of the things we got new is the Hoberman Arch at the Salt Lake City International Airport. Have you guys seen this arch? Do you remember it from the Olympics?
No, you were telling me about this, but I saw it in the Olympics on TV.
Yeah. Okay. I got to talk about it a little bit because I love the arch. It was at the University of Utah when I was there. It was downtown before that. But anyway, now it's at the airport.
Yeah, it's a neat thing. To me, it's part of the living legacy of the Games. And I work a little bit with, some of our Olympic leaders. And, you know, the date is July 24th. So get that, right? That's our statehood day kind of day. And that's when the next meetings are, when they think that the International Organizing Committee.
So next year, July 24th, is when they're going to announce who's going to win?
Well, what they'll announce.
Or tentatively?
I'm not going to get it right. So people that know this better than I do, please forgive me. But you enter into an agreement to work towards the Games and you get under signature. And, the thinking is that our most likely is 2034, but there's still a chance 2030. But we are America's choice. The Games will come to Salt Lake City again. It's just a matter of when, and we'll know a lot more in July. So
this is what happens when you do it too well the first time.
Yeah. Really interesting.
But I also think there's a huge benefit. So I'm a little bit, I'm a little Olympic skeptical. I think that
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah, I can't say I'm fully anti because when it comes on and then I'm screaming USA at the top of my lungs, then I know that I really do kind of
face
love it.
Face paint and everything.
But, you know, I'm a joiner. I'm a cheerleader. I was the mascot at my school, so let's be clear. I love many elements of it. I like that we've kept the infrastructure, but these can often be things that really disrupt economies in the places where often people are working under pretty extreme and sometimes quite awful conditions when we think about these big sporting events that happen around the world. But the fact that we've kept our infrastructure, a lot of the sporting infrastructure, and kept that up and continued to use it really means that the overall cost and displacement, you know, is less for a community like ours. But I do think there are concerns about what it might mean for housing costs, for increased kind of challenges that often come with these events, these kind of key events that happen in communities.
I'll just say that it is amazing what Salt Lake City has done for the Olympic movement of being like a model for how to do it well and right, to host a Games that's that successful, that earns a profit, that reinvests that profit into facilities, and then importantly develops facilities that aren't just about the Olympics but are about year-round sports amenities for residents.
I think about the Kearns.
Kearns is a great example.
Yeah.
The ice sheets there.
One of the things you didn't mention that I think really stood out to me was volunteerism.
Yeah.
You think about all the volunteers
that made
that
happen.
That's
what helped make a profit. Yeah, that's what helped make a profit. And so,
and I think that was uniquely Utah.
It's a beautiful story. Well, we should talk some politics or something a little bit more controversial. Medicare prescription drugs, John. I think I know where Shireen comes down on this, but we now have the federal government announcing the drugs that they're going to go negotiate with drug companies. I worked at Health and Human Services. There were people that wanted this back then. That was a long time ago. It's now happened. Basically makes it so the federal government has more, you know, market power against big pharma. The argument against it is that it hurts innovation. Where do you come down, John?
I'm highly skeptical of the government getting anything right when it comes to healthcare. So
okay. That's
where I come down.
What if the market, though? This is the government using the market to negotiate prices.
So we have the government that screwed up the market in the past. They screwed up the market. And so, you know, I'm supposed to have faith that the government is actually going to be able to truly get the prices down and preserve innovation and deliver prescriptions to the elderly. At the same time, where I have decades of history that show how they've screwed it up and how the government and the prescription drug companies collude with each other to make sure, you know, the prescription drug companies still make their money.
Mm-hmm. I would suggest that a lot of what you're describing there is problems with the private sector, not government. When two drug companies collude, for example.
No, I'm talking, this is the government itself. If you look at the disruptions we have in our healthcare market because of the government and decades of government involvement, each year after year after year, it just makes it worse and worse from my perspective.
I was going to say, that is one perspective. So what has happened here is that this is something that there has been actually over the years bipartisan support for. Unfortunately, in this piece of legislation, not a single Republican voted to lower the costs of prescription drugs for seniors in this country. And what this act had in it was a number of different pieces that are related to the cost of drugs. So when we think about the fact that often drug companies are increasing the prices of commonly used drugs at a rate that outpaces inflation. Now, if they do that as a part of the Inflation Reduction Act, they will be required to pay back to the government if they do that, right? Additionally, we're seeing this big issue around 10 prescription drugs. These are common issues that they're addressing: heart failure, diabetes, certain blood cancers, rheumatoid arthritis. Many seniors, I think the number nationwide is about 1 in 4 Americans cannot afford their prescription drugs. For seniors, that number can often be a bit higher. The White House says that the senior citizens paid $3.4 billion in out-of-pocket costs for these 10 medications in the last year alone. So when we think about ways that the government could meaningfully reduce the cost of healthcare, negotiating these prices down means not only that the government will be paying less for them, but that hopefully people will be able to take the medications that they need. I think this is a huge win for seniors in this country. Another piece of the Inflation Reduction Act was capping seniors, or those who are on Medicare, their drug costs at $2,000 a year. That goes into effect in 2025. This is transformational for families, for seniors who are unable or often have to choose between medication and what they're going to eat.
Interesting. John, when I say the term K Street, does it mean anything to you?
It's the lobbyists back in back in D.C.
The only reason I mention it is if you walk along K Street, you see a lot of big pharma. And
they've been told which side their bread is buttered. And
yeah,
so they lobby to make sure the money keeps flowing to them.
Yeah, well, I'm going to be really in the productive middle between John and Shireen on this issue to just say that big pharma's got its problems and government has its problems. But at the end of the day, what I'm thinking about is if you got diabetes, if you've got heart disease, if you're a fixed income senior, I sure want to get you those drugs.
Yeah.
But Natalie, if you look at decades, how many decades have we heard that the federal government is going to drop the price of healthcare? Does it go down?
Yeah.
It seems
just
to
keeps
keep going
taking
up
a
for
larger and larger share of our GDP.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And because we fundamentally fail to invest in people's health and well-being in moments when it matters, and we let people participate in a system that is driven more off of crisis intervention than it is off of keeping people healthy. And that is going to be immensely expensive and continue to get more expensive as we have an aging population.
Well, watch how the money flows. I mean, the federal government is incentivizing it such that we're losing primary care doctors because the money ain't there to be reimbursed as a primary care doc. It's there for specialties. Mm-hmm. And this is being driven first and foremost by the federal government.
Yeah. Shireen, John, did either of you attend the meeting see the news coverage where our Congressman Burgess Owens talked about parents in school?
No.
Missed it. Did you watch it?
I did not. I did read some of the news takes. You know, he's basically making an argument for more parental involvement. Love that. Love, love, love the idea of parents getting more involved in schools. But he really takes on what's termed as the indoctrination of students at colleges and universities. And of course, it caught my ears because there's never a list of the most meaningful parts of our country to the future of the world than our colleges and universities. We have the best colleges and universities in the world. People come from all over the world to attend these institutions, and these institutions foster the greatest innovation engine known to man. And to talk about indoctrination when I think of the beautiful mission of higher ed. Now, I work in higher ed, full disclosure, but one thing that binds us all together in higher ed is we love our mission. Thoughts, comments?
Well, but you've seen university presidents over the years starting to express some concerns about the silencing of free speech and other things like that.
Yeah.
And so you even see some university presidents expressing what I think Congressman Owens would call indoctrination. They don't call it indoctrination, but they do say we should have a culture of free exploration at our universities. And in too many cases, that's being stifled.
Yeah, so interesting.
I read a really interesting article in The Atlantic by David Brooks recently called How America Got Mean. Did you read it?
I've read this. I've printed it out for people.
Yeah.
I recommend it to all of our listeners.
And one of the core arguments is that we are building a culture that's devoid of moral education. And when I think about some of the things that are being challenged by some of the more extreme voices on the right to me, thinking about conversations about slavery or what we can teach about African-American history, what we can teach about some of the most dark periods of our own history, what we can say about those and whose feelings we're trying to protect around that, I think that we miss opportunities to have deep insight and reflection into what builds a moral fabric of a society that we want to have. So I hope that we challenge this. I would encourage people to go read this article. But yeah, I'm concerned when I see comments like this. And what I really hope is that we find more ways to expand our thinking, our inclusivity, our minds, and as opposed to railing against indoctrination without really an alternative to how we build a moral and just society.
Yeah. John, we'll give you the last word.
Well, we talked more about parental involvement. And if we really want to go down there to local control, here's one of the things that folks on my side of the aisle need to recognize. While I may not agree with critical race theory as promulgated in so many places, there are people that do think that is critical to teach in schools. And so if we're going to have local control, we're going to have some schools choose to teach it and some schools choose not to teach it. Or else we're stuck with the dynamic of we're going to mandate whoever has the most political clout, you're going to teach our agenda.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point that your local control is someone else's, you know, difference. So,
but I think if we did that, we would just continue to see a further fracturing of common understandings of history and knowledge and perspectives, ideology, faith, even like the way that I have some common ground there. But I also think that when we do that, we continue to divide us further and further apart, as opposed to saying, are there some common ideas that we can engage in that would help build our shared kind of moral understanding of what it means to be an American? And I think that's falling away.
Big topics today on both sides of the aisle. Stay tuned for our second segment.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. We are taping this program a week early because of Shireen's travel schedule. I hope you're going somewhere fun.
I am going somewhere fun. So I was
And she's not taking us.
I'm not. Though I don't know if it would really be your cup of tea. I am headed to see Beyonce.
Oh.
I'm going to Vancouver. I decided I wanted to go to a city I've never been to.
I'm busy with Taylor Swift.
Are you Swiftie?
No.
I didn't think so. But Natalie, I wanted to ask, I've been reading these articles about the impact that the Beyonce tour in Europe, but then also just in the United States, but even more so the Taylor Swift tour is having on our overall economic trends in the U.S. Do you buy it? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm one of those economists that only sees economic impact when you bring new money into a place, right? So if you're Vancouver this weekend, whenever you're going, there's going to be an influx of, you know, wealth into the community, but it leaves somewhere else. So it doesn't make a net, you know, growth in the global economy, so to speak.
Yeah.
But it sure is fun.
Yeah. It's another way to think of it is that the entertainment dollar is kind of fixed. You know, you don't get to just create.
Go to a concert, you go to a movie.
It's just like if we add an NHL team, to our city. What's the economic impact of that? Well, it either takes money from MBA or Symphony or dining out.
Does it, though?
Well, if they come down from Evanston, it's net new. But when you recirculate within the existing economy, it's just moving money around and the entertainment dollar is more fixed. It's definitely a boon to wherever it goes.
Right.
You know, like so it could be a boon to Draper or Salt Lake City. But from the statewide economy, yeah, the evidence is really clear that you know, that's why the people don't like subsidies for stadiums.
Yeah. Well, we bring this up because if something very newsy happened in the last few days and we're not talking about it, it's my fault. And I'll just let you know, I'll report back from Beyonce and then we'll just have to catch up when we get back. But I'm wondering if you can talk about, Natalie, I've been noticing just some news coming recently out of, you know, I guess it was the Chamber maybe released a report and then some of the larger economic trends. It seems like, again, Utah is performing extremely well in what was an uncertain economic time. Can you talk about some of the trends that you're seeing and then, you know, where you're at on recession?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a tough time to be an economist because there's a lot of uncertainty and there's a lot of mixed messages. And you in one day can hear something that makes you think, oh, we're going to have a soft landing. This economy is doing really well. And then another day you can be like, whoa, consumer sentiment is plummeting. Credit card debt is up. Look at gas prices, interest rates. So it's really complex right now. And I guess I would just say, and then John, pull you into the conversation here, but I would just say it's better here than almost anywhere. So be happy about the circumstances we find ourselves in Utah, but also don't get too comfortable because there's some rough trends out there. High interest rates, you know, exact a cost.
Exact a cost in business, exact a cost in terms of everyday living, other things like that. Yeah, I always tell folks, and too often people forget about this because when we come out of a recession, all of a sudden it's like, oh, we want to spend and we want to have a good life. And that's the time you start, you know, setting aside that nest egg for the uncertainty of the future, for the rainy day that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so right now when the times are good is when we should be setting aside something for those rainy days that you know are going to come. The economy cycles. Whether we like it or not, that's just a reality of life.
So I listened to a really interesting conversation today about some broad and concerning economic trends in China. Mm-hmm. When you're looking kind of out at that broader landscape, how much do you think kind of the uncertainty, and it sounds like there may be four kind of key things that are coming together in China right now that are creating a lot of uncertainty and worry about recession there. Like, how do you think that impacts us or how should people be thinking about things like that?
Well, I think the ties between the United States and China are more significant than most people realize. They are the workforce, the manufacturing engine that supplies a lot of what we purchase, and a lot of American companies are there.
Directly the components that go into the things we purchase.
I've been to China and I've seen some of these, and it's a visual you don't forget. I mean, waking up in a city that you can't pronounce the name and just seeing tens of thousands of cyclists on a road headed to the factory to go work with their hands. Doing things that we would maybe do with machines. You know, it's really interesting. And then to have them need us so badly, but also have such an ideological difference with us.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's going to be interesting. But jumping off the economy, but just one last thing to say is that don't take your eye off of commercial real estate. That's a really interesting part of the economy right now.
Why?
Because of COVID and people working from home, it's made commercial real estate not as attractive, high interest rates, nothing to build. We've got a lot of big things going up in Salt Lake City and other places around the state. But it's and then parts of commercial real estate, hotel and lodging doing pretty well, warehousing distribution doing well, but office space
poorly.
In a funk.
Yeah.
And then that spreads to, you know, restaurants and
some people
daytime population.
We'll just convert those over into housing, apartments. And there's all sorts of different rules and regulations and placement of windows and everything else. That there's a lot of cost there to do conversion.
We are rapidly approaching 9/11. And 9/11 is an important date for so many reasons. But Shireen, it's important for you because it's the anniversary of when you left for the Peace Corps.
It's the day I left.
What a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is Moldova. So, you're headed to Moldova from?
We flew out of New York City.
Okay.
Of all places. So
Chișinău, you might say differently.
Yeah, Chișinău. That's the Moldovan, the Romanian pronunciation of it. Yeah. Okay. So I actually lived and worked in the capital city. But, you know, I think there were many things that led me to that decision. But certainly being in college during 9/11 and then sort
sort of seeing these, you know, increased tensions globally and thinking about ways that I could serve my country and that was meaningful to me and I hoped would be meaningful in a broader sense. Signed up to do that the year that I graduated from college, and that fall actually got married in August, and then the two of us got on a plane and served in Moldova together for 2 years. So that is a 20th anniversary coming up. But it's really for me been a big part of, I think, my whole it shaped my worldview, certainly my commitment to and the way that I feel about this country. And then I think also a lot about service more broadly. Mm-hmm. And I just would love to take this moment to ask people to think about if there's room in your life to give a little bit back to your community. And I know many people already do engage in lots of ways to serve their communities. But when we're thinking about these uncertain economic times, when we're thinking about the kind of increase in loneliness in our communities, the way that people feel more and more isolated, find those ways to make connection, whether it's something as I think it's simple as donating blood or, you know, maybe signing up for Meals on Wheels, if that's something you could do, maybe signing up to do food rescue with Wasteless Solutions or really so many ways that you can serve your community. If you like pets, whatever it is, like animals, you can do something to give back. And it's a great way to build community. And I would just encourage people to think about adding something if they can this fall.
Yeah. Yeah. John, I'd love to hear you just chat about service just for a minute. In my household, my parents taught me this saying that the first person served in service is the server.
And I totally agree with that. It's, you know, when you do service, sure, you're helping somebody else out, but you get this good feeling about how you help them. And so you're absolutely correct. And to Shireen's point, I think service can be anything as simple as taking your elderly neighbor's garbage can out to the curb to doing much larger things like maybe helping students with reading in a Title I school or volunteering in the community for different events and other things like that. You know, my wife and I were privileged to host Christmas for 200 plus disabled individuals for about 19 years and stuff like that. And it was just, and it was rallying the community around to help make sure they had a great Christmas and stuff. And so there's lots of things that people can do. And you talk about 9/11. One of the key things I remember about 9/11, despite the horror that it was the unity that came from it. That everybody having a shared focus and mission. We were all united as Americans. We weren't squabbling about various little policies here and there. We were all unified in terms of our view and our concern and wanting to care for those that had been injured or killed or were left motherless or fatherless or lost family members in those tragic events.
Yeah. Shireen, when I use the term 1,000 points of light, does it mean something to you? And I only say that because you're so much younger than I am. And, you know, I remember when it was said live.
By Dana Carvey. Saturday Night Live.
By President Bush, Herbert Walker Bush. But but that's a little bit what we're talking about. And I only bring it up because sometimes service gets politicized.
Yeah.
You know, and it turns out that in our state, it's a big secret of our success. It's these networks of trust and service and collaboration, relationships.
Yeah.
One of Utah's big secrets.
Yeah.
What else do you guys want to talk about?
Well, so I know that we're talking about kind of some, you know, trends in our city, things that we're seeing from road construction to everything else. But on a more serious note, there's been quite a lot of news about, you know, what's happening on the homelessness front. And the announcement, I think we briefly talked about it on the show a couple of weeks ago about some sanctioned camping sites. Those are in negotiation between the city and the state to try to find the right location. It's a pilot project. The idea is that there will be supportive services that are embedded in that. But I'm wondering if you know, have anything to offer on what's happening there.
I would share this, and John, give us a Capitol Hill sense of this, but there's a lot going on behind the scenes. And I know our governor to be thinking very seriously about this. I know our two mayors, I say that because they're the urban mayors in Salt Lake County and Salt Lake City, putting a lot of thought to it. We've got Wayne Niederhauser, who's the state homeless coordinator. And I guess what I would say is that there's been a lot of infrastructure put in place. A lot of hard work from the homeless resource centers to the state taking ownership of this to putting in a coordinator and now to put in the funding and things that that are needed to provide the extra housing, the deeply affordable housing, the shelter in place kinds of things. These are things that are brewing. And I guess what I would say to listeners is keep a close eye because this state is on the move trying to serve the human dignity of some of our most vulnerable people. John, did you get a take on this in Capitol Hill?
Well, I wouldn't say from Capitol Hill, but the dynamic, I think, from everyday Utahns is, yeah, sure, that's good and fine. The infrastructure has got to go in place. But have you actually solved the problem? What are we doing to reduce homelessness? That's where I think most everyday Utahns want to see what is actually taking place.
Yeah. And the word you're going to hear over and over is trauma.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
It's a multi-layered and complex problem. And we know that individuals, you know, largely I think people kind of have this idea that people choose to be out on the street. I think lots of circumstances suggest that that's maybe the only place that they may feel that they can go. We can do a lot more in this space, and I'm grateful for everybody in the city and state who's really working to try to find solutions.
Yeah. I just, for a last segment, I just want you guys to give someone advice, something in your world that you're working on that people would find interesting. John? You got to have some audit about ready to come out or some database.
We're going into our audits of public colleges and universities. It's our busy time of year. And so we focus right now.
Yeah. Well, this is a little odd, but I'm getting ready to go and watch the eclipse. We have an eclipse coming that's going to pass across Utah. It's in October 14th.
And I have a daughter that's expecting a little boy in the next few weeks. I'll become a grandmother. I'm super excited for
that. Congratulations.
Yes.
That's fun.
It's excellent. It's something I'm really looking forward to. Well, it's been great talking to both of you. Thanks for your friendship. And John Dougal on the right, Shireen Gorbani on the left, Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. Our program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening, everyone.